formalism, which was describing how to properly look at submanifolds in a manifold, and the rationale behind this is that we want to take a fresh look at our action and think about boundary terms. So I'm going to apologize for chewing a sweetie here, but I think I'm coming down with something, so I'm just going to probably be a little bit foggy this lecture. So I'll continue with Gauss-Kadazy. I want to derive a relation between the Riemann tensor on the submanifold and the Riemann tensor on the sort of bigger manifold, so that you see how the Riemann tensor in our big manifold breaks up into something parallel to the submanifold and information about the perpendicular variation. But I just needed to formally introduce the connection on sigma. Which is, of course, simply inherited from the underlying manifold. So you just take the covariant derivative within M and then project it down onto sigma. And that gives you your covariant derivative of sigma. The other piece of structure, although we won't be using it, I just want to write it down for completeness, if you have just an hypersurface, codimension one surface, you can imagine that you're capturing all the geometry by looking at the intrinsic geometry of the surface and this extrinsic curvature. But if you've got higher codimension, you might imagine that your manifold's connection has some bits which are parallel to sigma, but also it's going to have some information orthogonal to sigma. And that is indeed the case. The normals can also vary across sigma. So an easy way of seeing this is thinking about the z-axis in R cubed. Two normals to that surface, that submanifold, a line in R cubed, could be d by dx and d by dy. So in that case, as you move up and down the submanifold, your normals are just parallelly transported. But a perfectly legitimate alternative might be to spiral your normals around as you move up and down the z-axis. I mean, you're not adding any curvature. This is like a gauge choice. But then you can see that this ought to be giving you something slightly different because your normals are actually varying as you move along the z-axis. And that would be sort of analogous to choosing a sort of non-flat coordinate system in Cartesians. Like, you know, if you choose spherical polars or cylindrical polars, you get non-vanishing pieces of the connection, even though you're still in flat space. So, to get the normal fundamental form, you take a derivative of a normal, you contract it with another normal. This is anti-symmetric in I and J because I've chosen by basis of normals to be mutually orthogonal. So ni dot nj is 0. If I equals j, then this would be a half grad of n squared, which is just 0 because n is a unit vector. And it also lies within sigma itself. So these are the connection. So like I say, I'm not going to really make use of this, but for completeness, I'm just mentioning. So now we can relate the two Riemann tensors of the submanifold and the manifold itself. So the first bit is kind of nice and straightforward and makes logical sense. You're simply going to take the higher dimensional Riemann tensor and project it into the submanifold. But of course, that's not the whole story, because you can kind of think of choosing this submanifold as choosing a particular way of coordinatizing the higher dimensional manifold. So you're slicing M, if you like, with a sort of little set of sigmas. And so you might expect that, you know, that there is some information when you project down this higher dimensional Riemann tensor, which is actually lost, which is nonetheless legitimate curvature in the lower dimensional Riemann tensor. And so that information is carried by the extrinsic curvature. So we'll just see how this works in the case of codimension one. Little n is the codimension. No, big N is the big dimension. Little n is the codimension. So just for the sake of simplicity, I'm going to take codimension one. And I'm going to think of a space-like normal. So in other words, what that means is H is G plus NN. So this would be the situation if we were sort of looking at these boundary terms in evaluating our action, because typically we want to set a boundary at some space-like. Distance. So we want to show this. So how do we define a Riemann tensor? Actually, am I spelling this right? So if I think of a vector which lies in tangent to my surface, then the Riemann identity is just given by a commutator of coordinate derivatives. Wrong index there, apologies. So that's just the definition of the Riemann tensor. But now we know how to replace these sigma covariant derivatives with m covariant derivatives. So what we do is if we look at this grad C, for example, that's saying take the covariant derivative of the tensor one index down, one index up, and project all of those indices onto the submanifold. So this is HCE, HDF, HAG of grad E sigma covariant derivative of V. And then I have to now replace this sigma covariant derivative . Okay, so now what I have to do, obviously when this grad hits the grad of V, then I've got my second derivative of V, so I can see that I'm going to get from this, you can sort of see the Riemann identity in the higher dimensional manifold coming out. But I've also got to take derivatives of the first fundamental form. And if you look up here, the first fundamental form is G plus NN. So when my manifold covariant derivative hits G, I simply get nothing because it's a metric connection. But I've also got the covariant derivative hitting each N. And every time the covariant derivative hits an N, you get an extrinsic curvature. So now you see where some extrinsic curvatures might come from. So I simply have to just plow ahead and actually do that. So for the first bit, where I'm looking at the derivatives on V, if I pull this covariant derivative straight through here, I've got these two H's that come out. This H meets that H and gives me a delta, another HDM, and this one meets that H, which gives me an HAN. So I've got that's the part where I'm taking the second derivative of V, and you can see that this anti-symmetry in C and D here is going to induce an anti-symmetry in E and M, which is good because those are the differentiating indices for V. So this is going to take me to the Riemann identity in the higher dimensional manifold. Now I've got to look at the derivative of each of these in turn. So this is going to give me a covariant derivative. Perhaps I should just write it out. So now I look at my individual covariant derivatives here. One is going to be HFM times the derivative of HGN. So I said this just sees these ends here. So that's going to be ng kne plus n n kge. And then I've got plus h ng. And I've got nf km e plus nm kfe. Sorry? Do I? Where? And so I do. HEC, HFD, HAG, that must be. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. I was just carrying them over. I wasn't doing anything at that point. Okay, so let's look at these four parts in turn. Here I've got an N, G, and that's going to hit that H and give me zero, because N is orthogonal to sigma. In this case, also, I've got an NF, and I've got an HF there. That's also zero. If I look at this one here, I've got KEF, which sees these two H's, so that brings that KEF to a KCD. So when I anti-symmetrize, that term will go. So really, you're seeing that the only thing you're left with is this term. So let me just pull that information together. The top line, I said, because this is anti-symmetrized on C and D, it induces an anti-symmetry on E and M, so I can use the Riemann identity here. So I just now get my higher dimensional Riemann tensor. So we can see we've already got one of the pieces that we want. I look at this one here. And then finally, as I said, this term is killed by anti-symmetry. So now, if I look here, because V was tangent to sigma, N dot V vanishes. So I can simply reverse swap N and V here at the price of a minus sign. So this here is minus Vn grad m n, which is just V times a k. So what I'm actually left with, if I pop it over here, use B. So what I've done here, because I want to be able to remove the V from both here and there, that V is parallel to sigma. So I have to actually explicitly do that, make sure that I'm picking out only the parallel part of Riemann, this point to sigma. And then I've got minus I'm trying to make my indices match here. So we've got KAE. So that becomes K. Just a minute. Don't write yet. I want to make sure. So my KAE going with HEC becomes KAC. And then I've got KMNVN. So if I look here, I see that that H is simply going to change this M here to a D, and this M here to a C. And so I get the result. So this means we now know how to relate the curvature of our full manifold down to the curvature on the submanifold using extrinsic curvatures. So there are, as I was alluding yesterday before starting on this whole calculation, there are several applications or several ways in which you meet this. You can use it if you are describing thin shells in Einstein gravity. But the real reason that I started deriving this was because I wanted to look at the action for various solutions to the Einstein equation. So let's go back. Now that we've got this machinery, we know how to deal with a submanifold, so we know how to deal with a boundary. Let's go back and look again at our Einstein action. This is what we're going to derive, the boundary term for the Einstein-Hilbert action. So when we derived the variation of the Einstein-Hilbert action, we found a piece that we wanted. In other words, the Einstein tensor. Plus some derivatives of the variation of the metric. So I'm now going to explicitly put in the boundary term that we crossed our fingers and set to zero last time. It's okay to take our actual field that we're varying to vanish on the boundary. That is the rules. Those are the rules of the game for Euler-Lagrange. But as I pointed out at the time, taking a normal derivative of the metric vanishing is a far stronger statement, because you're trying to pin the metric down, not just on the boundary, but also in a neighborhood of the boundary. So now I'm going to keep that, I'm just going to have that term there so that we keep an eye on it and try and figure out, can we add a boundary term to our Einstein-Hilbert action such that when we vary it, we cancel this off? And that is what this Gibbons-Hawking boundary term does. Okay, well, just like when we
should the two AB be contracted?
Sorry,
where?
Last term of the second one.
The del AB, del AB, del the GCC.
Oh, gosh, yes. So, yeah, absolutely right. I think I was already thinking of the second term there. Yeah. Thank you. Now, is everything else all adding? Yeah, looks like it's all. Yes. So when we did the Einstein-Hilbert action, we simply picked up a scalar, the Ricci scalar, varied it, and, you know, hit the jackpot, found what we wanted. So let's just try the same thing again. We've got a boundary now of our manifold. We want to integrate on the boundary. Let's sort of think about something which is a scalar. We've also got the information here that what we want to cancel off has something to do with the normal derivative. So this suggests that we use the extrinsic curvature. So that's what we'll try. So the variation of the trace of the extrinsic curvature is simply a variation of the divergence of the normal. So that's going to be a divergence of the variation of the normal. And then we have to allow for the variation of the connection coefficients. Now, if our surface, our boundary is fixed, then whatever happens to the normal, it can't actually change in direction. It can change in so-called length. I mean, it's not really changing length, but I mean, the components can change in terms of their length, but not in terms of their direction. So what that means is that delta NA is proportional to NA. So I'm just simply using that to sort of rewrite that first term. And then, of course, I rewrite the second term now, which I need a grad somewhere here. And so I rewrite my variation of the connection in terms of the variation of the metric.
So what I really want to do here is to start, here I've got a delta G, so that's great. I'm going to have to work on it a little bit. But, you know, I've got something in terms of delta G. I now want to get this delta N in, in terms of delta G. So once again, I'm using the fact that my boundary is fixed. There's no variation of the metric on the boundary, which means that H doesn't change. So I can now write the variation in delta N in terms of a variation of delta G. So I'm just replacing this NB delta NB here with the normal part of delta G. So I've actually already managed to find a normal derivative of the trace of delta G, which is like this term here. So it looks like we're on the right track. So all we have to do now is manipulate this part into looking like that. So if I look in here, I'm simply going to take some covariant derivatives, actually go through. So in this case, this covariant derivative, if it hits one of these n's here, what this is giving me is a grad n of n. And I choose to extend my normal field off the boundary in a geodesic fashion. So I can always do that. So grad n of n vanishes. And so all I'm left with is this covariant derivative hitting delta g and hitting this n here. When it hits this n here, it just gives me k. And so this final bit here is where it hits the delta g. So what I now want to do in this particular case is I want to actually replace this pair of n's. I've lost where I've wrote, where I wrote down here, h. So h is just g plus nn. Because you can see this is almost in the form I want here. You know, it is like a normal derivative of delta G, but here what I really want is a projection of a divergence of delta G. And that's not quite what I've got here. What I really want is to say, I've got a projection here, but this is not a straight divergence. There's sort of more normals than I want. So what I've done there is simply replaced the two n's by an h minus g. So in this case, if I pull this n sort of inside, what I've got is then the internal covariant derivative of this vector. But pulling the n inside means I end up with a grad a n c. Which leaves me with k contracted with delta g. So now if I look at that, what I see is this term here is coming up there. Looking at the top line here, this is a total derivative which lies within the boundary sigma. So when you see a total derivative, you can integrate it up and you say divergence of a vector throughout some manifold is the same as the vector on the boundary of the manifold, but of course we're already living on the boundary of a manifold, so our sigma has no boundary. So this is not really going to give me anything at all. And then I'm left with some pieces which are actually just proportional to delta g. So in the terms of Euler-Lagrange, actually I can forget about these because I've now expressed something in terms of a variation of the metric only on the boundary. But I'm just going to leave them in for the moment. So if we add this boundary term, we've got a factor of a half there, so that changes the 16 pi g to 8 pi g, then our Euler-Lagrange equations are completely legitimate. All we ever have to assume is that the variation of our metric vanishes on the boundary. Just hoping you'd have a bit of colored chalk. Again, when I sometimes put flags, I just want to put a flag against that line. The reason I want to put a flag against the line is notice it's kind of very like Einstein tensor, right? This is something which is a tensor living in the boundary, a variation of a metric on a boundary. So if we were doing a little bit more general Euler-Lagrange, where we allow our boundary to vary as well, to be a dynamical object, then we might end up with some equation of motion with the extrinsic curvature in it. Why would we want to vary the boundary? Well, it might be that we have some physical object which is extended in our space-time, and the physical object itself defines the submanifold. And if it's a physical object, then we would want to make it move. So at the moment, I don't want to do that, but I'm just flagging it up because that's something we're going to come back to. So this boundary term is the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term, because Stephen Hawking and Gary Gibbons actually derived it. And they then used it to correctly compute the action for the Schwarzschild solution. So I want to track back now to this Euclidean Schwarzschild solution. So let me just clear this board here for a couple of pictures that I want to keep up. So yesterday, we derived the Euclidean Schwarzschild as the black hole cigar. And I commented, so this was a periodicity of beta, that there was an alternative solution, which was simply flat space with time identified at the same angle. So notionally, this is a sketch. I'm going to allow myself a bit of leeway here. This is going to be R equals infinity. Okay? Now, as I commented before sort of finishing that lecture, there's a little bit of a problem here because both of these solutions have vanishing Ricci scalar, so both of them have a vanishing Einstein-Hilbert action. And yet, physically, you would expect to be able to distinguish between them, which means you would really expect that they would have different values of the action integral. And so that was what suggested that Einstein-Hilbert was not actually complete. And then we went back, we thought about what happened when you varied it, realized that we'd crossed our fingers at some point, and assumed a normal derivative vanished, and then looked a bit more closely at boundary terms. And we've added this extra piece to make our action now legitimate from an Euler-Lagrange perspective. So let's have a look at what this boundary term does in the case of the Euclidean Schwarzschild. So what I'm going to do, which is a common technique, is I'm going to compute the boundary term. I'm not going to throw in R equals infinity just immediately. You'll very soon see why. I'm going to cut my space-time off at some very large value of R equal to lambda. I'm going to compute the action for this cutoff Euclidean Schwarzschild and actually see whether or not it depends on lambda. It really shouldn't, but let's see if it does. So if I have R equals lambda, then my normal to this surface is going to be 1 minus 2gm on lambda to the half d by dr. So that's now got a unit length. It's the normal's obviously in the radial direction because we've taken an R equals constant surface here. And what we therefore want to integrate over is d tau, d theta, d phi. These are the three coordinates on our boundary. The d tau gives me a 1 minus 2gm over lambda to the half. And the d theta d phi give me lambda squared sine squared theta. And then, of course, I've got to integrate k lambda. So that's root g times k on the boundary. So k lambda is, of course, the divergence of the normal evaluated at r equals lambda. So remember, divergence of a vector is 1 over root g, which root g for Schwarzschild is r squared, dr, r squared, nr, 1 minus 2gm over lambda to the half. So that's our extrinsic curvature, just a divergence, and then I've got to evaluate, sorry, that's 1 over 2gm over r, evaluated at r equals lambda. Okay, so this is simply going to be 1 minus 2gm over lambda to the half. My first, if I just take 2 over r, get 2 over r from differentiating the r squared, and then I'm going to have, when I differentiate the square root of 1 minus 2gm on r, so that's what my extrinsic curvature is. So if I now look and put this up here, I'm going to get simply, should be a sign, Peter, sorry. I'm going to get the usual 4 pi coming from the integral over the 2 sphere. It's not dependent on tau, so I'm simply going to get a beta from integrating over tau. So I've got beta from integrating over tau, I've got 4 pi from integrating over the sphere, and then I just have to put in all these extra terms here. So I've got lambda squared times square root of 1 minus 2gm on lambda times k. So this gives me 2 over lambda 1 minus 2gm on lambda plus gm on lambda squared. So I multiply through by lambda squared, and I actually find that the integral of the boundary term is divergent. So obviously, this is a little disturbing because we don't want to have a divergent action. On the other hand, if we just set m equal 0, which would be like our Lorentzian space, and computed the boundary term for that, we would also get a divergent action. So this simply suggests that we do a sort of renormalization here, that we have to subtract off the flat space action. So we'd expect that to be 0. So what we're going to do we're going to also cut off our flat space cylinder at lambda But what we have to be careful is that we're integrating over the same boundaries. And if we cut off at r equals lambda here, and we look at our g tau tau piece, the length of our time coordinate is not quite, the proper length of the time coordinate is not quite beta. It's beta into 1 minus 2 gm on lambda. So we have to rescale our time coordinate in the flat space part. So in Minkowski space-time, or, well, flat space, k is just 2 over r. So the extrinsic curvature is now just 2 over r. But I've got to rescale my time coordinate. This really is coming from the integral d tau. So it's not like I've got no gm part in it at all, right? So in this case, what I've got is like this. So this is 2 over r. So I'm replacing my extrinsic curvature simply by 2 over lambda. But I've still got a square root of 1 minus 2 gm on lambda sitting in the action. So I still get 4 pi r squared. I've still got 1 square root of 1 minus 2 gm on lambda, but my extrinsic curvature in flat space is just 2 on lambda.
In the flat action?
Yes, no, I have to compare. I've got to integrate over the same submanifold. In each case, r equals lambda defines a three-dimensional surface. So I have to make sure that these are the same surfaces I'm integrating over. And the only difference is that here, at r equals lambda, if I look at the proper length as I go round this circle, I get 1 minus 2 gm, root of 1 minus 2 gm on lambda times beta. Okay? That's the proper length. So if I want to match from here to here, the theta and phi coordinates go across because they're both multiplied by lambda squared. The size of the two sphere here is 4 pi lambda squared, 4 pi lambda squared there. But the size of the circle here is just a bit less than beta. So what I have to do is I have to rescale my tau here so that its length, the length of this circle, is the same. So in reality, the periodicity here is just a little bit less than beta in order to make the two manifolds the same. So you've got to compare like with like. So you've got to integrate over the same boundary, the same three manifold. So that's why that extra term is there. So it's why you're not just subtracting off this, because that wouldn't be comparing like with like. But the period is the same. That's the whole point. This is the periodicity here is the periodicity of the coordinate tau, okay? But the proper length of the circles is varying as you move in, which is why you get the cigar. In flat space, the proper length is exactly the same as the periodicity all the way through. Okay, it's the difference between the coordinate and something measurable. Okay. Yep.
Here it works pretty well because The Schwarzschild met the universe as a nice boundary surface, mm-hmm. and you have a canonical way of embedding it in flat space. Mm-hmm. Is it always possible to find which how to embed the surface, the boundary,
in the right background
in flat space?
You mean? Well, you don't always want to embed it in flat space because you might be computing an action in the scissor space, for example. So
you compare to the background.
So you kind of compare it to a common sense background. Okay. So I think so. It's not that may not be flat space in every case. So let me just finish this off. So obviously, what I've got here, if I do an expansion of the square root, I've got 4 pi beta times 2 lambda, and then I've got to take a square root here, which is going to be 1 minus gm on lambda plus so on and so forth. So this tells me this is 4 pi beta into 2 lambda minus 2 gm. So putting this all together, my Euclidean action subtracts at the boundary term, so it tells me that my Euclidean action is minus 4 pi beta into 2 lambda minus 3 gm plus 4 pi beta into 2 lambda minus 2 gm, which is 4 pi, oops, I've got to divide by 8 pi g, sorry. Sorry, Peter, I'm over 2, I knew what I was heading for. Okay, so this is the action of the Schwarzschild solution. So I run out of time, so I can't show you how you can use that to derive things like entropy, but maybe we'll either do that next week, or I might set it as a tutorial question or something. Okay, that's it.